Good afternoon. So last time we were talking about signalers. So this was a thing that on Unix kind of looks like hardware exceptions, except instead of it being something the hardware does, it's something the OS does. And we learned that kind of the implementation of this, that the OS is sort of using hardware exceptions to get to run, because that's how it always runs, and it's kind of emulating the sort of things the hardware did to get it to run, but with your program. So when a hardware exception happens, the hardware kind of modifies the program counter to start running the OS. When a signal happens, the OS modifies the program counter's tracking for your process to run a signal handler you set up earlier. And we learned that there are these signals for lots of sorts of events, some sort of that you're familiar with, like what happens with control C or seg faults, sort of trigger these signals. And usually when they're not handled, the OS says, well, there's no handler, I'll just terminate this program. And otherwise, if there is a handler, it calls it, sort of interrupting whatever code was running at the time. And often, as far as how the OS implements this, it looks like kind of the OS is forwarding these exceptions it's getting from the hardware as signals to you. It's converting them from sort of one form that it gets to another. Then we looked at the syntax for registering signal handlers. We mentioned, you know, sort of to be careful about thinking about signal handlers that, well, they don't work if you haven't registered them yet. You know, they don't work if the program's not running because they exist for interrupting your program. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so as is not surprising, whenever I talk about anonymous feedback, people discover that the anonymous feedback tool exists. So got some links of the form. You know, maybe I'm spending too much time on questions during lecture. This is a tough balance. I know I'm repeating myself. I know, and I'm probably a little on the high end sometimes. Also mentioning, could I use something like Poll Everywhere, a tool? I've thought about it. It might make things more efficient, especially since sometimes there's more trouble communicating questions that might be avoided by having them written down. On the other hand, my main reason I haven't explored these sorts of solutions is I don't like giving people more incentives to be on a device during lecture than they already have. And besides sort of taking questions during lecture, got feedback on both sides of the, was the quiz, are the quizzes ridiculous or are they not? Okay. It's things I'm thinking about. I'm not sure where the line is. I don't have a representative sample. One thing that's also brought up here was the lab yesterday. So I will say, for the record, that lab was a little bit longer on average than I wanted it to be, or at least longer for too long for too many students than I wanted it to be. It's definitely improved since the last time, but we haven't done quite enough. For that. And it's mostly I need to figure out how to make the debugging issues, which are usually the cause of people taking longer than we expect, less likely to happen. And I think we got rid of a bunch of them by giving you correct code for reading the PIDs, which when people didn't have that, it turns out people broke that code in weird ways. But I need to think about what else we need to change about the lab to make it, you know, not be quite so tight on time. So questions on anonymous feedback or the lab? Yes?
Will that affect how the lab is graded at all?
Question, will that affect how the lab is graded? I'm not planning on doing that. So as is mentioned in the syllabus, I'll do sort of adjustments based on difficulty at the end of the semester to the overall weighted grades. I'm not gonna try to do it assignment by assignment. Yeah? Where can you get anonymous feedback? On Canvas.
Yeah.
There should be a tool on Canvas to do it on the Canvas course. At least other students have found it. Yeah. So question, are labs dropped? What if you're sick on a lab day? Labs are not dropped. If you are sick on a lab day, you should contact me about doing something to replace it. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
I guess whenever we go over quiz questions in lecture, does that account, like what we actually learn in lecture, is that accounted for from the amount we take upon the quiz, or are we missing out on information that we could be learning?
When we go over quiz questions in lecture, is that accounted for?
Does going over the quiz questions take up time from the actual lecture and like
the end? The question is, going over the quiz questions take up time from the actual lecture? I always expect to cover less lecture material than I have, so it just affects how much that happens. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about signal handlers, and most of you, hopefully, or all of you, I hope, used them somewhat in the lab yesterday. And I'd like to talk about why, signal handlers, they look great, and they're a lot less useful than they appear in practice. And the big reason is something called signal safety. So here I have a signal handler that does something very simple. It says, you press Control C, uses printf to output that. And I have a function foo that, we're gonna have Control C be pressed during. And this function happens to use malloc. That's a very normal thing for functions to do because sometimes we want to allocate memory. And it turns out that this code is unsafe and invokes undefined behavior if we press Control C while foo is running. And that's really weird because I'm not doing anything that looks dangerous here, but this is because of what signals can do. And to think about why this is, let's think about how malloc is implemented. So there's tons of ways malloc could be implemented. We're not going to do that in this class. But we could teach a whole class of how to implement malloc. But one sort of strategy might be that we'll have a region of memory, you might call the heap, we'll have a pointer to it, and we'll increment that pointer when we allocate. So we'll have this pointer that says, where is the next thing we want to return for malloc? We'll get our thing to return, and that might be a way malloc would work internally. It's one possibility. And we could get nice and unlucky here and have our signal happen while we're doing the malloc operation. And we could have it be really unlucky and happen while we're doing in between these two lines here, sort of after we figured out what we're returning and before we've sort of advanced the where does the next allocation go pointer. So that's the necessary I was setting up. So why is that bad? Well, the problem is we don't know what printf does internally. And printf is used in our signal handler, and it might use malloc. So when printf calls malloc in that case, that we get that sort of lucky situation, then malloc is kind of calling itself at that line. Like it's not intentional, and moreover, malloc is not written to be called by itself in the middle of itself. Like it's not written with that in mind. And so this is going to cause a problem. So our malloc is running this sort of get the pointer to the memory, and it's about to increment sort of the next to return value, but it hasn't done it yet. Then we run our signal handler, printf needs to malloc something to do its work, and suddenly we have two buffers that we're using for two different things that are the same address. And this is gonna cause all sorts of weird things to happen, probably much later on, in fact, not in the signal handler when we try to use printf again. And this sort of scenario is likely to come up in a bunch of other ways just because most of the time when we're writing a function, we aren't thinking of what if someone calls my function while it's running. from within itself. We don't think of handling this scenario, and for good reason. It's actually really annoying to write code that can handle that. So questions about sort of why this causes a problem. Sort of an assumption. Okay, so we have this problem from sort of inadvertently requiring functions to be what's called reentrant, to handle being called within themselves. And you might say, how can we do anything in a signal handler? Well, happily, POSIX, which just defines the standard that Linux and most other Unix-like OSs follow, the ones that have these signal handlers we've talked about, defines a bunch of functions as what's called async signal safe, which means that they have to work even if we call them or related functions within themselves. Unfortunately, the list of async signal safe functions is very short. It's not super short, but it's omitting a lot of things you would expect to be on a list of functions for you to use to do things. So for example, printf, malloc, and xset are not on the list. Write and underscore xset are, and there's more, you can look them up. But this means that for writing a signal handler that you want in a real application that needs to work consistently, you either need to limit yourself to only these functions or ensure that whatever you're interrupting is only using these functions. Questions? This async signal safety idea. Let's say, so this means that if you actually want to write real signal handlers, it's pretty constrained. So one option that we have to deal with this is that we can say, let's just not have our signal handler run all the time. And POSIX provides a mechanism for doing this known as blocking signals. So you can make a function call to block a signal, and when a signal is blocked, when it can still be sent to your program, but it won't take effect. Instead, it will just become pending until you unblock it. So that means, you know, you can make a call to block a signal. This would be done with the sig proc mask function, possibly some others, and it's blocked. And that doesn't mean someone can't send you a signal. They can, but when they do that, rather than it running a signal handler, it becomes blocked and pending. And if you unblock the signal, that will immediately trigger the signal handler you have to run. Or if you don't have a signal handler, it will trigger the signal to be delivered, probably killing your program. So this is a strategy we can use to make sure signal handlers don't run when we don't want them to, but still have one registered. And we can also use this to kind of handle signals in another way, as we'll talk about on the next slide. So questions about this idea of blocking signals? Yes?
So with this, we should probably only block signals that we have a handler for, right?
Question, with this, we should probably only block signals we have a handler for. So on the next slide, we'll see a case where we might want to block signals we don't have a handler for. But we should choose which signals we block, and we can, we should choose which signals we block based on ones we want to do something with. And we can block each signal individually. So if you block SIGINT, you don't block, SIG user 1, for example. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
What would the parameters of
SIG proc mask be? You should look it up, but it's, the parameters are the constant SIG block, or sig unblock, and I think there's another option. And then there's a sig set T, which is basically a type for a list of signals. Because it turns out, rather than blocking signals individually, you can say, I want to block this list of signals or unblock this list of signals. Does that answer your question? And I guess there's also a set mask mode which says, I want to have exactly these signals blocked and no others that you can use. Is that okay? Other questions? Okay, so you can use this strategy to handle signals all you want to, and there's some special functions to support that. And there's kind of two ways we can use this. So one strategy is that we can say, let's block the signal all the time except some select times you want the signal handlers to run. And there's some functions that are designed to support this. So sig suspend and pselect basically support unblock signals and maybe run handlers and then reblock them before you return. So you can like have a loop where you call this function and it just unblocks signals for a little while, then blocks them again. Another strategy is that you can decide, let's not have a signal handler at all. And you can just handle the signals kind of directly from the pending state. So there's function calls which will basically look up what signals are pending. And sig wait is probably the most prominent of them. There's some others. The idea being that you recall sig wait instead of having a signal handler, and it sort of makes the signal no longer pending and tells you it was pending. And you can use that to handle the signal sort of not from a separate handler, but just in your normal sort of code, kind of like you would handle reading from a keyboard. So we get this sort of idea. And we can see an example of our call to sigproc mask to block a signal. So I have to specify it's a set of signals that just contains sigint. And then I call sigwait to wait for that signal to become pending and return when it was. Question? Yeah. What's the difference between blocked and pending and just being blocked? So if a signal is pending, that means when it's not blocked, it's going to be what's called delivered, which means running a signal handler, or if there's no signal handler, doing whatever the other action is, like terminating the program. So in this example, if we didn't stop it from becoming pending, when we unblock the signal, we'd either run its signal handler or do something like terminate the program. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, do both of these strategies get around the unsafe function? Yeah, so the first kind of strategy, only unblocking the signal at certain times, gets around it because we know we won't be interrupting a function that could be manipulating things that our signal handler will also manipulate. And the second strategy gets around it because there's no signal handlers, nothing's being interrupted. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Question is, what does sig suspend do? So I didn't show you the details of how it's called and all that, but basically you tell it what signals you want to unblock, and it unblocks them and waits until the signal handler for them runs, for one of them to run a signal handler, and then returns with them blocked again. Yes, I believe it reblocks them afterwards, yeah. And you should read the manual page to know how to use it. I'm sort of giving a very high-level overview, and certainly not saying how to call it and what all the corner cases are. Other questions? Okay, and I'm mentioning this sort of these ideas of signal handler safety and these other ways of handling signals because in practice, I recommend trying not to write signal handlers for the most part, or if you are, doing it with this sort of very limited way where they only run at very particular times, just because it's really hard to write a program that won't have a bug otherwise. Okay. So that's where I'm gonna finish up talking about signals. If you look at the schedule, we have a timing homework due next week, which you should know everything you need to know to do it. The idea of this homework is we're gonna have you sort of time a few things which correspond to events we've talked about. So we're gonna time something that corresponds to a function call, which you know from CS01, what a function call is doing. Have you time a system call, a simple system call. And we're gonna have you time sort of sending a signal in various ways and also running a whole new program. And when we have you time sending a signal, I'll have you time sending a signal to another program, which is also gonna time kind of switching from program to program. So we're kind of looking at sort of how long it takes our system to do these various things that we know the OS and the hardware are doing lots of work to do with exceptions and the OS running for bits of time and so on. I'm gonna look at that in that homework. Also mentioning it to remind people that it exists on the schedule and you might wanna get started, not next week, maybe. And as I mentioned, one of the things we're gonna time on that homework is sort of running another program. We're just gonna tell you, here's a function to run another program, but we're gonna talk about more about how that works as our next topic. So questions before I move on to that, about the homework. Okay, so we're gonna talk about the interface that Linux-like systems provide for managing processes, sort of as an example of like, what can you do to actually sort of start and stop processes? We talked about what processes were, and we kind of glossed over, like, when I type ls, how is the shell sort of starting a new process? What does that look like? And we're gonna talk about what that interface looks like and what the OS is doing a little bit, not in that much detail. And we've seen in the lab, we saw this get PID function. So we saw that every process has an ID on Linux and most Unix systems, it's a number. We haven't talked about sort of creating processes. So we're gonna start with creating processes with fork. And before I get to that, you might notice looking at the summary that I've separated creating processes from running programs. And that seems a little weird. And it turns out that the sort of Unix API for this has decided that those are separate steps. So we're gonna have one way to make a new process, but that new process is not gonna be running a new program, it's gonna be running the same program, just in a new process. And we're gonna have a separate thing that's gonna change what program our current process is running. So the way we make a new process is gonna be with fork. Fork makes a new process. You might say, it doesn't take any parameters. You might say, how does it figure out what the new process should be doing? It just copies the current one. And because it copies the current one, this means it returns twice. And we say, well, wait a moment, how is it returning twice? Well, the stuff it's copying includes where we are in our program right now, where all our registers are. So after it does the copy, we have one copy that's about to return from fork and another copy that's about to return from fork because we just copied all the information. So when we run either of them, the first thing they're gonna do is return from fork. And to help you distinguish between these two copies, fork's return value is gonna be in the original process, the new process ID, and in the new process, which we call the child process, and therefore we call the original the parent, gonna be the constant zero. You might say, what if I want to know the PID if I'm in the child? You can call getPID. And basically everything in the process is duplicated when we make this copy. So all the memory, all the registers, all the open files, talk about how those work later, and so on. So, question, yes?
How would you get the parent PID?
How would I get the parent PID? The simplest, so the way that you already could figure out is call getPID before fork. Another way is that there's a function getPPID for getParentPID. Yes?
So, showing off that, like, why doesn't it just return the parents PID and then the child PID instead of the child and zero?
Question, why does it just return both PIDs? So we want it to help us in figure out which process we're in. Like, technically, it doesn't need to do that because we could call get PID and figure it out afterwards, but it's easier if it tells us what process we're in somehow. And probably because they were writing in C, they just discarded all ideas that involve returning more than one value from a function. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, that mean returning zero versus the new PID is just to differentiate the different processes? That's the primary purpose, yes. Yeah?
The child's PID is
zero? So question, the child's PID is zero? No. Zero is just returned and to the child to indicate you're in the child. If you want to figure out the PID in the child, you should call getPID to find it out. I think kind of the logic is that the parent process, the original one, is the one that's going to need to know the PID. The child probably doesn't really care because the parent wants the PID because the parent might want to do things with the process it created. The process it created probably isn't trying to do anything that needs a PID most of the time, and that's probably why they chose this design. Question, the parent and the child have the same, technically have the same PID? No, they have different PIDs. So we make a new PID for the child. And the original process, since we didn't change it, still has the same PID it had before the call to fork. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Can a child call fork? Absolutely. Yes?
So if the parent and child wanted to share some memory, how would they coordinate that?
If the parent and child wanted to share some memory, how would they coordinate that? So they could use things like what you did in lab. Those will still share the memory. And they could use that either by both of them doing all that stuff after fork. Or if they did it before fork, because that sort of space was allocated to map to that SHM open thing, it would stay shared. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Does the PID represent anything? Like, is the child's higher number necessarily or not?
Does the PID sort of have higher numbers depending on what it is? Not necessarily. So I guess if you're looking on Portal and most Linux systems, typically the PIDs are like assigned sequentially, but that's definitely not required, and there are real systems that don't do that, like assigned PIDs are random. Yeah?
I guess I'm kind of wondering how this actually looks. Like, let's say you do this in the command prompt. If these two processes are running, are they let's say they both print stuff later, are they printing the same command prompt? I don't get how this,
So the question is, if these two processes are both running, do they both print to the same command prompt? Yes. If they both try to read, usually there's rules about the terminal saying only one of them gets to read at a time. In fact, just whoever wins, probably. But they're trying to use the same resources. Most of the time, we're going to have some code after the fork that will make them do different things, as we'll see in some examples later. Yeah. Question? So to think about how this is implemented, a way we can think about it is that the processes have some information the OS is tracking. So we have the register values. We have the address space, which we mentioned as page tables. We'll talk about what that looks like later. We have the open files and probably a bunch of other information. And when we call fork, that just copies this whole thing and also copies all the memory. And then we make some edits to the registers to have different return values depending on which process we're in. Yeah? Question, is this how parallel processing works? This is a way parallel processing can work. It is not the only option and probably not the most common. Other questions? Okay, so something that this title of this slide alludes to is that you might say this seems a little inefficient, and you're gonna say this seems a lot inefficient when we talk about what we often do in the child process. Biggest reason it seems inefficient is we're copying a whole bunch of stuff that might not be so useful. And we're going to have a fix for this later, which is going to be known as copy on write. But for now, I'm giving you the simple model where we don't have that sort of performance improvement. So yes, you're correct if you think this seems awfully slow and we could do this better. Yes, we can. And we're going to talk about one option for that later. We'll talk about another more obvious alternative is maybe we should use something other than this fork idea, but that hasn't catched on in the Unix world that much. So let's do kind of a little example here. So here's some code that calls fork and prints PID. So I make my call to get PID and I print out the parent PID. Then I call fork. And if I'm in the parent process, meaning I get a non-zero positive PID, then I print out my PID again, and the child PID. If I'm in the child process, I print out my PID by calling get PID. And I have this else case because fork on an error returns -1. You might say, how can it fail? Like if we're out of memory. It will fail, return -1. So we check that and just print that it failed. So a way we can visualize what this, and this is the sort of diagrams I'll be making for most of this, is that we have a program running. It's going to print out the parent PID. Then fork is going to be called. We're going to have two processes running. And they're running side by side. And they're going to possibly run at varying speeds. So one possibility is that we see the parent print first and then the child. Another possibility is those could be the other way around, because they're running side by side and, you know, whoever runs faster gets to print first. Questions about this example? Yeah?
The context switch happen when it prints one to the other?
Question, does the context switch happen between when one prints and the other? So yes, if we have one core. If we don't have one core, not necessarily. If we have more than one core, not necessarily. Yes?
So child is going to start on the same line where parents, where the fork happened?
So the child is going to start on the same line where the fork happened? Yes. So the first thing the child is going to do is return from fork, which is the same thing that the parent's going to do after the call of fork. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Yeah. Question, if I want to deviate what the parent and child do, I can just use a big if and else if. Yep, that is the most common pattern. Other questions? Okay, so since we've seen an example of fork, an example here, so let's suppose I run this and the parent process has PID 99 and the child has PID 100. What are two possible outputs? And let's assume there's that fork doesn't run out of memory or anything like that. Okay, who can give me one possible output? Yes.
I hope I'm not wrong. So maybe
it'll say child 100, then done, then in child, then done again.
Okay, child 100 done, then in child, then done. Yep, that is a possible output. And what you're assuming here is that after we return from fork, that the parent gets to run fastest, and it runs to completion. So in the parent, the PID is not going to be zero, so we're going to run child 100, we're going to keep going, we're going to run done. And in the child, which is going to get to run sometime after that on your assumption, we're going to get in child printed out, and then it's going to keep going, and it's going to print out done. Yes?
I have a question. If the child is 99, does the fork set it to zero after the parent constant?
Question, if the child is 99, what do you mean?
The child process is 100, right? So, but in child will only run if the PID is zero. So, like, can you explain how it works?
So the question is, why is in child run if the child's PID is not zero? So fork returns zero as sort of a sentinel value to indicate you are in the child process.
Oh, okay.
Yes?
How do you know which one runs first?
How do we know which one runs first? We don't. So that means there's other possible outputs.
So it's like random or not?
So the question is it random? It's not literally random, but it's... But there's a lot of factors that can affect it, so it's not very predictable. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, could we have, as another possible output, child 100 in child done? And then another done? Absolutely. And as you said, that's assuming you have a context switch that basically happens, in your example, after we pick child 100, there's a context switch, or we're running on two different cores, and then the child process catches up, or something like that.
So it doesn't always run to completion?
Sorry?
So it doesn't always run to completion?
So the question, it doesn't always run to completion? Yeah, so the same idea, if you like open up two terminals and run two compilers in them, right, you don't have any expectations about the relative speeds. These are two separate processes that get to just kind of run freely with each other. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
I'm a little confused, like, how do you get the outcome of in child's done, like, as one of the two possible outputs?
So the question is, how do I get in child done? Are you expecting there to be one less done in the output?
Well, I was more thinking of like when exactly did it become zero?
When it could become zero? So our semantics for fork are that it returns zero in the child process as a sentinel value. Think of it kind of like a null for PIDs. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes. Question, are there two more options with basically the other sort of swapping these two and swapping these two? Yes. And sort of I have my two canonical answers, but yeah, not the only ones. And I'm showing sort of what pattern we would imagine if these were happening on a single core. Yeah.
How would done get like print, or how would like in child get printed before done? Like, how is this the right option?
How is the red option possible? In the red option, the parent runs to the end of main before the child gets a chance to run for the first time, just because the parent's faster.
Yeah, so then wouldn't done get printed? Like, I don't get how there'd be two duns in a row.
Question, how can there be two duns in a row? So in that example, the parent runs up to printing this out, and then the child catches up, or we switch to the child because of a timer, and the child prints out, and then we eventually go back to the parent sometime later. Does that answer your question? And they both print done? Yes. Yeah?
Can you prevent context switches from occurring?
Not on OSs you're used to using, but you know, if you have enough control over the OS might give you an interface for doing that.
like in that child process, PID is like automatically set to 0, right?
Question, in the child process, the PID is automatically set to 0, yes. So note that the PID here is just telling us what fork did. It's not like telling us our PID in that case. Yeah. If we're in the parent, we get the PID of the child after fork, yes. And a way you can think about this is, otherwise, how would you ever know that PID? Because you can't get it from, like, get PID. Okay, so let's do another example with fork. Who'd like some more time?
Question.
Question, yes.
Can a context switch happen while printf is executing, so we could get print some x and then like it does something else and goes back to printy, or is that not?
Question, can a context switch happen while printf is executing? Yes. Am I imagining that in this scenario? No, but yes it can. Yeah, and it depends how printf is outputting, whether that might split the output up. Okay, so who thinks A is one of the possibilities? Okay, B, C, D, okay, E, okay, F, U. Okay, so a plurality think A and D are. And we have some scatterings of people who think the others are possible. So only A and D are possible. And I have this example because there's a very common misconception people have with fork. And that is that they want, we're both running with the same variables. They want them to still be the same variables. But remember, we make a copy of everything. So after fork, we have two different X's and Y's. And it doesn't matter where X and Y are stored. They're either in the memory. We've copied all of that, including the stack and all the global variables. Or they're in registers, and we've also copied those. So the variables are completely independent of each other between the two processes. If we want them not to be, we are going to have to do extra work with fork, like setting up shared memory like you saw in the lab. Yes? So question of X and Y were in some sort of shared memory, we might have some other answers, yes. But obviously, you know, variables we just declare like that are never going to be stored in that one. Other questions? Yes.
So why is defined after you call fork? So how is it copied?
Why is defined after you call fork? How is it copied? So I guess it's not copied. It's actually definitely independent. But the answer would also be the same if I move the definition of y up. Like, it won't change anything. Other questions? Yeah.
If you declare a pointer before calling fork and then modify whatever that's pointing to, can that change the other program?
So question, if we declare a pointer before calling fork and modify what that pointer is pointing to, can that change the other program? No, and this is because we have address spaces. So remember that when we're running a program, we have your addresses go through this mapping to the real addresses. And the OS, when it makes a copy, makes it so the mapping takes the same input addresses. So both the parent and child will think there's something at every single address that they thought before the fork, but now they'll go to different real addresses. Yeah? Question, the only way for this sort of shared thing to occur is if you like write it to a file or read it out. That is one way. The other way would be like with the SHM open kind of stuff or similar interfaces like we saw in the lab. Does that answer your question? Okay, yeah.
X plus equals 1 by default calling fork, would that not show up in the child since it runs after the fork or does it show up?
So question, if I did X plus equals 1 right before calling fork, like I added this here. So in that case, the value of 1 would be copied into both processes, and they both start at 1 after the fork. And we'd increment that to 2 in the child and to 4 in the parent. Does that answer your question? Yes? No? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've talked about creating processes, and somehow we talked about creating processes without ever talking about writing any other programs, which is probably, when I said creating processes, is what you wanted to do there, right? You wanted to like run a compiler, you know, run something, not just run more of my program that is already running. So our mechanism for that is going to be a bunch of library calls which all start with exec, so execute. I'm going to represent them as exec star. As we'll see, there's a bunch. I'm going to show one of the things that comes in place of the star, but there's a whole bunch. But they basically all do the same thing. They just take their arguments in different ways. So what the exec calls do is they replace the current program with a new program, but we're still in the same process. We just replace what's running in that process with a different program. So it has the same process ID, but it has all new stuff loaded into its memory and its registers. And I'm going to show execd as one of the variants of exec. There are a few others, but as I said, just different how the arguments look. And it takes a path, which is the location of the executable file we want to run, and it takes argv, which is the value for argv that's going to be passed to main when that program is run. And it's terminated by null because we didn't specify an argc. That's how it's going to figure out what the argc needs to be. And typically, you're going to see exec used in combination with fork, but that's even though that's not strictly required, that's typically how you're going to see it used. So a very common pattern you'll see is that we'll use fork to create a new process, and our code in that new process is going to immediately run exec. So in this example, I'm running the ls command. So when you type ls minus l at your shell, well, there's typically no ls program in the current directory. It has to be somewhere else. And on Linux, the most common location for it is slash bin slash ls. So that's what I'm supplying as the path. And we need to supply the value of argv, and I'm specifying that the argv of 0, which is by convention, doesn't have to be, but by convention is the name of the program as you would have typed it on the command line. So I'm specifying ls for that, just to do what my shell, my command line would do. And I'm passing minus l, and then I have a null to indicate that's the end of the arguments, and I pass that to exec. And exec here normally doesn't return. So when it's successful, it replaces the current program with a new program. That means the old program can't keep running. It's not part of the process anymore. So if it's successful, it will never return. If it does return, that means something went wrong. Like we ran out of memory, binls was not the right file to run, something like that went wrong. So in my code here, I first print out an error message with p-error and then exit. I exit because if I don't exit, what's going to happen? Well, on an error, we would keep going and run whatever code is down here. That's probably not going to be very helpful. So I'm just going to exit to make sure that doesn't happen. Yeah?
So if that's the case, do we really need the else if there?
Question, do I really need the else if there? No. Except that we probably do want to check for the PID being -1 to indicate an error. Yeah?
If this is still the same process, does that mean like the address space and all that is the same too?
Question, if this is still the same process, does that mean the address space is the same and all that? Yes, but exec is going to load new stuff in the process. As we'll have a clearer picture of this on the next slide. Other stuff? Other questions? Sorry. Okay, so let's look at sort of what's happening. So we mentioned we have this sort of information about the process, which places sort of the info about the process, which is commonly called the process control block. So we have our registers, we have our address space mapping, we have our open files. And what exec is going to do is it's going to load the new program. So basically, we're going to load a bunch of stuff from the executable file. We're going to set up a new stack and a new heap. We're going to copy the arguments into that new stack, most likely. So they'll be available for main. Then we're going to reset all of the register values to be what we want to do to start the program. And we're going to get rid of all the old memory we're not using anymore. Questions about this picture of what exec is doing? Yes?
Just making sure if the address of the executable doesn't match with our command, it was still executed, but would probably just return an error, right?
Question, if the address of the executable, you mean that this path?
Yeah.
So what you're asking, what if this path here doesn't match this? So that is not an error as far as exec is concerned, because we're specifying two different things. The path we're specifying as the first argument to exec is just what program to run. And if, let's say, you know, I set this to, you know, something that's obviously wrong, like, you know, vim, then exec, we're telling it to run ls. It's binls. It's going to run that program. Now, when we run that program, we're going to specify these values for argv. So if the program checks argv of 0, it will notice it's weird. And that could cause a problem if the program cares about it. If the program doesn't, it won't matter. So probably, if we supply a bogus value in place of ls, it won't do anything. If it does do something, it's not because exec is caring about it, it's because the program itself cares about it. And sometimes you'll find programs like ls will, sometimes you find they won't. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So does this process coming out with the also point like valid or something? Is there anything left over at all from that just
Question, is there anything left over at all from the old process, except for the things we copied? Nope. Not in the memory, that is. Yeah?
Well, is that ever, like, if you have a multi-core, in a multi-core setting, like, will it transition to a new core at all, or will it stay on the same core?
Question, will the program stay on the same core? That is up to the OS. It could decide to change to a new core if it wanted to. Yeah? So you're saying, gosh, it seems like in this example you're showing me, we have, I'll do this in a different color. So we have here, we're going to copy a program's memory. And here, we're going to make a new program's memory. Memory. So are they in different spots? Yes. So we're making we're in total, we end up with three copies of a program, two different programs across them. And this seems awfully wasteful because basically we make a copy for fork and we use that copy for a couple of instructions and then we stop using it. So this is indeed a thing that makes fork seem a little wasteful and inefficient. We'll talk about the optimization I mentioned earlier of copy and write, which will make it slightly less bad. But there's still good cases to be made that maybe this is not what you want to do. Maybe we should have a different API. This is not what this sort of Unix world has decided on. I guess, for the most part, has decided on. I guess if you look in more detail, you'll find that there are also alternatives to forks that are kind of in between fork and some other things we'll talk about, that are maybe a little more efficient, but still have the same idea. Other questions? Okay. So we're getting to the inefficiency idea, and so I'll just talk about that explicitly. So we could just have a function to create a new program, and in fact, you will find these functions in APIs on Windows. This is the interface that is provided. Windows basically doesn't have fork. Instead, it has a function called createProcess that makes a new process that's running a program you specify when you call createProcess. It doesn't copy anything, just starts something from scratch. POSIX has a function, so the Unix systems, that called POSIXSpawn that's kind of designed to do the same thing. As I note, it's rarely used, and usually, even though it provides the same interface that something like createProcess provides, it's usually implemented using fork. Or a function like fork. There's something called bfork and a few things that are like fork, but not quite fork. So you might say, given that we could have this other API, why did the people who made Unix in the 70s decide fork is the API we want? And I think the big argument in favor is that, if we look at createProcess, it takes lots of arguments because we need to configure how the new process is running. What directory is it in? What files does it have open? And all these sorts of things. And if you want any of that to be configurable, you probably need to have it be part of the createProcess arguments, or you have these sort of things where if you want to run a program in a particular directory, you need to switch to that directory even if the rest of your program doesn't want to be in that directory, for example. So it makes it easier to configure. So to configure the new process, createProcess needs to take a lot of arguments, versus with the fork idea, the idea is that we can do whatever we want to configure how the program is running in this code that runs before execv. That we can just write code that changes to another directory or opens different files or whatever we need to do to set up the program's environment using the normal way we do that in a single process. Whereas with Windows, you kind of want to have two copies of the interfaces for that. You want to have a change directory for my program and a change directory when you're starting this new program sort of interface. But of course, there's the big disadvantage that it requires us to implement this copy everything code, which could be annoying to implement and or slow. So it's not good. So I mentioned we have this POSIX spawn, and since we use Linux, I will show you sort of an example of what using POSIX spawn would look like. You can see it has lots of parameters, and my simple example, I just passed null for most of them, but it has lots of parameters because there's lots of things we want to do to set up how the new process is running that with fork we just do by writing code that runs after fork and before exec. Yes? Question, fork allows the OS to avoid copying all the code? Fork allows the avoid the OS having to, needing to have like two ways of setting up sort of the state for a program, right? We can just reuse all the change what my current program is doing rather than needing to have a way of specifying how should I start this new program. But fork requires the OS to copy the whole sort of processes state to implement that. But the idea is that when we do that, that means we don't need to have separate ways of setting all the things you're copying. You just set them in the normal way and then copy them rather than needing to have a function you can say to make a new one and then set them in a particular way.
So it prevents
a kind of code repetition? Yes. That is the argument for fork. Yeah. So question, why copy of the current process instead of some other template? I think if we were copying off some other template, we'd want that sort of start from scratch idea anyways, most likely. But they copied off the current template because that helps you, that's most natural when you're trying to run a program in a particular way, right? That you set up the state and then run exec. Question, is it because we can't predict how we should set things up? I would say there's a lot of things we do want to be copied sort of from the current program that wouldn't be in a template. So for example, if you're running something in your shell, you want the current directory it's in to be the same as your shell usually. So you want that sort of information to be copied. There's a bunch of other stuff like that where it really makes sense to copy it. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so, but there are opinions. So as an example here, this is a paper from 2019 from the Hot Topics and Operating Systems Workshop, which is probably the premier venue for academic grants about operating systems and early stage research papers on operating systems. And you can see these authors here arguing that fork is a clever hack for the machines and programs of the 1970s that has long outlived its usefulness and is now a liability, and it's a terrible abstraction for the modern program to use and compromises OS implementations. So there are people who really don't like fork, but if we're on the Unix world, we're kind of stuck with it. And they figured out how to make it pretty efficient, despite it seeming not to be. Questions? Okay, so next we'll talk about, so I talked about exec and fork and not using fork and exec, but why we might want an alternative. So one thing we started about sort of starting programs, we need to wait for programs, and the interface I'm going to show for that is wait PID. There's some other ways. And wait PID sort of has this prototype. It takes a process ID to wait for, and it takes this pointer to a status, which is going to be filled in. And it takes some options, which we will just leave at zero, but you can set sort of change how wait PID works. And it waits for a child process to finish. You cannot wait for a non-child process. So it has to be a process that you started with fork. Other processes you can't wait for, sorry, if you want to know how they exited or wait for them to exit, this interface is not going to help you. And status, the thing that status points to is going to be set to status information. This is going to be like the exit code. So if it exited, you know, from exit something, it's going to be that number. Or if it segfaulted, that kind of information is going to be encoded in that number. And there's some functions to decode the number because it's like, it's not just the exit code, it's kind of the exit code and did it exit normally or did it like segfault or something like that. And you might say, why does it return a PID? So it returns a PID, first of all, to tell you if it fails for some reason, and secondly, because you can pass -1 as the input PID, in which case it will wait for any child process, whichever finishes first. So as an example, I can do, the most common pattern you'll see is we'll start a child process, and in the parent, so note that my if statement is checking for nons greater than 0, we will wait for the child, and in the child, I'll do whatever I was doing, often like calling exec. And if I wanted to, I could, you know, could do something with status there to like figure out, did the child exit normally? Did it segfault? Did it, you know, what was passed to exit? All that stuff. Questions? Code here. So the pattern you'll typically see is that, you know, we'll fork our parent process, we'll call wait PID, our child process, we'll do something and call exec, and, you know, if our parent's calling wait PID, it's because we don't want to keep going until the child process does whatever it wants to do. So this is like what your shell typically does. When you do type ls on the command line, it waits until ls finishes. This is kind of the mechanism it's using to do that. Now, a question you might have is, I'm calling wait PID here before the program actually exits. The common question is, what if I call it after it exits? And it turns out, not a problem. So you can call it afterwards, and that'll still work. This means that the operating system is going to keep around that the program exited in some bookkeeping information until you call wait PID. So if you don't call wait PID, you're going to kind of keep memory allocated to track that information. It also means that PIDs won't be reused until after you wait for them. Yeah.
What are you waiting for?
You aren't waiting, but wait's purpose, but basically wait's gonna say, oh, I don't need to wait, here's the exit status, it's done. So even though it's called wait, it waits if needed and gives you the information about how the program exited. And then returns. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And so, in our last few minutes, let's do this exercise. So, Yeah, if you don't know, the echo program just outputs its arguments. Who'd like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. So I should go over, I guess, so who thinks A? Thank you. B? C? D? E? F? Okay, I get E. And what I think is going on here is that we have a parent process running, and it calls fork once, which runs echo L1. It calls fork again, which runs echo L2, and we wait for them after both, you know, have started. So they're running simultaneously. They can run at any speed relative to each other. So we'll have L1 or L2 printed kind of basically just based on how fast they run. So it could be either order. I think there's a common confusion where people want us to sort of call fork in the child process. That's a thing we can do, but it's not done in this code because execv, once this happens, remember, sort of doesn't return. Some questions? No, I'm out of time. Yes?
So, you mentioned that there was a sort of can it start in either order? Why is that? Because
question, why can't it start in either order?
Like, the fully would have to be one.
Yeah, so I agree that they start running at different times in that order, but how fast they run can vary. Does that answer your question?